Hey everyone, and welcome to the O Studio podcast, where we delve into the art of feeling better. My name is Tim Bateman, founder of O Studio, a New Zealand wellness franchise that's here to help you relax, recover, and improve your health and well-being. Today, Maddie, Soph and I speak with Crusaders rugby coach and What a Lad podcast host, Jimmy Marshall. I hope you enjoy.
Jimmy Marshall, welcome to the you've actually supplied us an intro you'd like read out. Are you okay to do that?
He texted it through, mate. I've got it here actually. So we've got your intro here, mate, that you sent through to us. So today we are joined by a great man, a great lad, some may say. Widely regarded as one of the greatest fullbacks the Hurricanes and Super Rugby has ever produced, whose lethal attacking skills helped the Hurricanes to their first ever Super Rugby title in 2016. Holder of the record for the most ever Team Man of the Year awards, he is now one of rugby's most promising young attack coaches. Away from the game, our guest is also host of one of the world's most successful podcasts called the What a Lad podcast, where his interview skills and style has been compared to that of Joe Rogan and Dr. Phil. Along all of that, he's a father of three, soon to be four, a husband, a great friend to many because he really is a great lad. It is none other than James Marshall. Welcome to the Studio Podcast, mate.
Wowee. Hey, I've always wondered what it's like to be on the end of a sort of made up intro.
Oh, well, we've never had a guest supply their own intro before. That was quite unique. Thanks for that.
Mate, I wish I could have said some stuff like that about myself, but honoured to be on. It's like, what a cool podcast that you guys have set up, and honour to be here.
It is funny. I always laugh listening to the podcast, and you just see the guys' reactions to it. It's like people just hate being complimented. They're on the spot. They don't know what to say. It's sort of like, oh, thanks.
Yeah. You feel so uncomfortable when you can't like agree with what he said.
Well, you didn't seem uncomfortable at all, mate.
Oh, I felt very uncomfortable listening to that. So many lies.
Yeah. Oh, funny. Well, it's good to have you here. Obviously, you're a rugby player, a podcaster. We've been trying to pick your brain regarding podcasting already. But I think, you know, a nice place to start would be, you know, rugby obviously is where your sort of career sort of took off. So, it's taken you all around the world, obviously from playing now to coaching as well. But I guess what pulled you into rugby initially at the beginning?
Yeah, I'm not too sure what actually started it all for me. I always loved rugby as a young kid. I used to love going to the games. I lived up in Auckland. Used to remember getting up watching all the All Black games. I guess my old man used to love watching it, and I used to just love watching it more than anything to start. Used to love playing it with my brother in the backyard. But I don't know where the actual love for the game started.
You probably described a pretty typical Kiwi kid, to be honest.
I think every Kiwi kid sort of grows up with that same sort of love for the game. And I guess it does start from the parents or the siblings and just playing it. And yeah, for me, it was more around watching it than playing. I remember when I was five, my parents tried to take me down to have a game, and wasn't for me. It was too rough. I remember crying on the sideline. My brother, who was three, was into it, and it made me think, I don't know if I'll be able to play rugby, that's for sure. So I stayed at soccer, but I always would watch so much rugby ever since as I can remember, really.
It's such a big part of the foundation, like the visualization part of the game, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah.
What parts of your character do you think that developed, made you, like, allowed you to be successful in it afterwards, do you think? Like, when was that moment where you were like, I've gone from a spectator to, okay, this is making sense, I'm into it?
Yeah, I don't know, because when we moved down to Nelson, like, all my friends were playing rugby, so that was, like, the natural transition for me. Then I gave it a go, but I was still not great. Like, there's photos of me, I was literally picking, like, flowers or, like, looking in the grass, or I wasn't that into the game, but just the more I watched, the more I sort of, I guess, was learning and really wanted to be a professional rugby player, but never thought it would be possible. And then it got to the point, I remember missing out on the under 16 rep team and still really wanted to be a professional rugby player, but realistically, if I couldn't make the rep team in Nelson, how likely was I to become a professional rugby player? I thought pretty low, but I was still telling everyone that was sort of what I wanted to do after rugby. So I was a little bit sort of embarrassed when I'd say it because of that. And then I thought I'd give it a really good crack, go really hard for 2 years and try and be in the first 15 by the time I finished Nelson College, and got a gym membership for my Christmas birthday present combined from my mum and dad. And I just went hard at the gym and trained really hard for those couple of years, and things started to happen for me quite quickly. So it was a real lesson around the more I put in, the more I was getting rewarded, and it was a vicious cycle for a couple of years. And yeah, things just happened really quickly from there.
It's funny that the work ethic thing is something that's sort of come up a lot and sort of preparation for this, you know, talking to different people, like, you know, Jimmy wasn't born gifted, you know, with this just natural talent that sort of was, he was always going to be there. But just that developing that work ethic. And also there was a funny part of it too that I sort of heard in conversations was you sort of almost seem to figure out actually the way people are picked, you know, the way people are picked in teams is actually coaches will justify it by numbers. Yeah. You know, they'll be like, okay, he's got this is how big his bench is, this is how big his squad is, this is what his beep test is or his yo-yo. And it's almost like you clock that system a little bit where you're like, actually, these guys are actually, if I'm being told that I'm too small, you know, if I can get my strength up or I get my fitness up and I develop this real sense of work ethic, that you will get picked in teams. You know, where did that work ethic come from? Because, I mean, it's not normal, you know, at 15, 16 years old to go off and push yourself really hard.
And I don't know where it came from, but you're so right around how teams were selected. And I feel like I did work that out at a youngish age when I was in the academy. Often the reasons I wasn't getting picked was I was not strong enough. So the only measure they had on strength was your bench press and your gym scores. So that's why I got the gym membership, because I knew that would be my quickest way into them not using that as an excuse to pick me. I was always pretty naturally fit. I used to love running. I'd run everywhere, like run home after a night out. Like I wouldn't catch a taxi. I'd always just run home and pretty much time myself. It'd be like probably 3K to my house, and it'd almost be like a 3K time trial, like every time after a night out.
2 a.m.
Like,
in the morning.
2 a.m., whatever. Some people would have thought this
guy. Bag of Macca's in one hand.
This guy's mad. But yeah, those are the sort of things that I knew were going to hold me back from being picked in teams. So got myself a big bench, got myself good gym scores, and was good at the fitness test naturally. The first one that sort of held me back was New Zealand 19s, was my speed time. Mm. They said I looked faster than I was in the scores, and I was gutted at the time because I knew I was quicker than the score suggests. So I just basically had to teach myself how to run the speed lights. It's a different type of running to, and the fact that they would use that on selection used to break me, but I knew that that was the way to make myself be a fast rugby player was by doing a quick speed, lifting the knee higher at the end, basically running four strides before a knee lift, like just to get you're talking microseconds. And the following year at 20s, I had a way quicker speed time over 10 meters. And they said, oh, you've been obviously training really hard on your speed. You've taken a huge amount off. But I basically just learned to run through a speed light. So
well, I mean it's the combination there of work ethic but working smart, isn't it? You know, like, as you know, they're two very different things. You know, you can spend your time working really hard on something that doesn't actually end up being that important, but you sort of seem to understand, okay, these are the things that I really need to work hard on. But then you also really worked hard. Like, I did see something on this, you know, you got into a professional rugby environment and you thought the way you looked at professional rugby was, oh, they must be training so hard. That David Goggins style training, I think is what you talked about. And then you got in there and you realised, actually, I've been training way harder than professional rugby players have been training for. I've been doing that since I was 16.
Yeah, well, that was literally my first realisation, was that my trainings that I'd do by myself at the park were so much harder. And my commitment to chasing the dream was so much more intense. And especially my first interaction of professional rugby, which was Tasman, early days, so still pretty amateur. But guys, you know, would be smoking, and like, I couldn't believe that professional rugby players would be smoking cigarettes. It just blew my mind. And then to hear that All Blacks would be smoking and drinking so much. And here's me trying to make the 20s, going 6 months with no alcohol, like fully committed to my diet, training every day. Like I was, that was probably my first shot was, man, I'm actually training way harder than anyone else.
What's the sacrifice for that like? Because, you know, it's obviously, you know, it's easy to say now, but when you're 18 and 19, like every 18 and 19 year old knows there's lots of different things, people pulling you in different directions, and not many of them involve training, not drinking. Yeah. You know, like what was that like at that age?
I've never really bought into the whole peer pressure thing. I've always found like I sort of want to just do whatever I wanted to do. I know I was definitely drinking. I was having most weekends I'd be down at the nightclubs, like I said. But there's just this patch leading up into the 20s where I just thought, this is an opportunity to fulfill my dream of becoming a professional rugby player. So a little 6-month period to fully commit to it and give it a real good crack. I think I would have regretted it more if I didn't do that than not taking it seriously and falling short. So I gave it everything I could to make that New Zealand 20s side and still didn't make it, but I've got no doubt that if I didn't do that, I wouldn't have transitioned into professional rugby as quickly as I did post that, even missing out. So, yeah, it was sort of just a decision I made at the time to give myself the best crack to fulfill a dream, really.
It's quite a lot of self-awareness for a young guy. You know, like I think most 18, 19-year-olds, you know, aren't probably, I mean, maybe that's potentially the difference, you know, like, but like that's, we talk a lot about self-awareness, I assume, you know, and it seems that you sort of had that or developed that quite young.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have a clue where it's come from, or it's still something I feel like I've had throughout my career was that self-awareness. I often think whether it was too much self-awareness or maybe it held me back sometimes because I'd be almost too self-aware of my limitations or things like that. But I definitely always felt really aware of my strengths and weaknesses and the best way to try and pursue my dream. And like I said, I don't know where it came from, or I'd love to know and love to be able to feed it on to my kids or help them with it, because I think it's such an important skill to have, is that awareness of yourself.
It's the master skill, right?
Yeah.
If you have that sort of...
I think most podcasts we do, they come back to like what's the key learning self-awareness, like each time it is.
Yeah.
It's massive. And I think the big one I love about this story is you've obviously had the passion before you've actually had to do the thing.
Yeah.
Like you've obviously been drawn to what rugby was as a culture and a spectacle. So you've already had the buy-in. And then, you know, those missing out on the 16s, missing out on stuff has actually probably escalated your ability to push through and try almost more effort. Like it's almost I think failure for kids is often a one where they just, that's the full stop. They're like, oh, I didn't make it. It's not for me. Whereas people that can almost think, nah, I'll try a new version of me and see where it takes me is often where they get that big success coming.
That passion piece is like, I think so important. You see Massive. It. It's so often, you know, you see it a lot now where you can basically make any passion of yours your career now, like just the way the world works with social media and opportunities. Like you could be literally doing anything, walking along the beach and recording your walks along every beach, or anything, playing blackjack every day, 10 cents a follower, like something like that. Like you can literally make a career out of any passion that you have. So if you are really passionate about something, I'm so for giving it your biggest crack possible, and it'll become easier, like your failures and when you do hit hard points throughout your journey, if you're really passionate about it, just becomes a lot easier than obviously if you're not that into it.
I think you always told at school, right, to follow your passion.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was so you enjoyed your life, but it's actually not. It's that because if you want to be good at something, you actually have to have unusual amounts of perseverance, and you only get that if you're passionate.
That's it.
Right? Like if doesn't, even if it's 10 cents a follower or walking on beaches or whatever, if it doesn't excite you, you won't do it long enough to actually become successful.
So true. Yeah.
It resonated with me when I heard that.
Quick question. When you think back to early days, like little Jimmy watching rugby with your dad, what kind of a spectator was he? Was he like a positive spectator, or would he get like really emotional ups and downs?
Nah, he was pretty normal. He wasn't like really into it. He'd just sort of sit back. I always remember if we went to a game, he'd always want to leave the game early, which used to annoy me. So he wanted to beat the traffic. So like no matter what the score was, whether it was close or whether it was, he was one of those guys who wanted to get out like 5-10 minutes before the game had finished. And that used to annoy me. Like, this is the best bit of the game right now. It's going to Golden Point or whatever. But no, I've got to beat the traffic. Let's go. Oh, it used to break me.
So good. Because I wonder if that's where it comes from. Like, I often think about that with kids. Like, how do you instill that kind of passion in kids? And it often is us observing the people that we love being passionate about something else.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to see if that has a knock on.
Yeah.
That's the sort of supporters piece or people that, you know, are alongside on the journey. It's often overlooked, you know. Like, I know we've talked a little bit about work ethic as being why you sort of got to where you got to, but, you know, people helping you along the way. You know, I touched base with Andrew Goodman, obviously up in Ireland now, and I know he was a big part of your development too. And I asked him why he thinks someone like you became, you know, successful in what you did. And he it was really interesting. He talked a lot about curiosity. So just you were constantly curious, you know, constantly trying to find ways to do things new. Interesting conversations all the time. He talked about work ethic, obviously, as well. But, like, how important is someone like him for your development? You know, we've got a lot of people who, you know, are pursuing things. How important is a strong mentor, someone that's in your corner?
Yeah. Oh, mate, he was massive for me. And that's interesting to hear his words there around curiosity and work ethic. But like my 7th year at school, he was a teacher at Nelson College. So he wasn't my teacher, but used to see him quite a bit around lunchtime, et cetera. And then the following year, went to the same club, Nelson Rugby Football Club. And he was my ride. I didn't have a car or any sort of transport. So it was either me running to places or he'd come and pick me up, and we used to train together. And like I said, some of those trainings that me and him did together were so hard. And he's just always been in my corner, still is now as a coach. He's mentored me all the way through as a player and now coach. And there's someone I've got so much respect for. Like, his work ethic is, talking about my work ethic, his is next level. Like, he's just incredible how much commitment he's given to the game. And it's awesome seeing him do so well now with Ireland and Leinster. But someone that I can always bounce ideas off or call if I'm after advice or anything like that. So
how cool is that, eh?
Yeah.
You know, just someone just prepared to give their time and energy to someone that they see something in. You know, obviously he saw something in you that was like, that he resonated with. He talked a lot about your energy as well, like you were uplifting to be around as well. But how awesome is that, eh? That, you know, I always admire people like that, that go out of their way to really help someone else. You know?
We became friends really quickly, but like a lot of people say, like, how are you friends with Goodies? Like, 20 years old. He's like, he is what, maybe 6 years older than me. So
you had the greys coming through.
So I probably look the same age. But but that was sort of like, I guess he just saw me and wanted to help me out. And when you're training together and spending that much time together, you become friends pretty quickly. And lifelong friends.
Absolutely. It's funny, like the things that you develop through rugby, you know, like you know, the skills that you develop, work ethic is one of them, obviously, we talked about, but like some of the funny skills that you develop as well are interesting as well. Like, empathy was one of them. I saw Kieran Kane actually must have said to you at one stage that you've got no empathy in the game. People wouldn't think that you can develop empathy through playing rugby. Can you sort of explain what happened there? What was that about?
Well, that was my first year at my second year at Tasman, actually. It was my first year sort of in control of the team at 10. And, went to my end of season review and sort of just sat down with Kieran and Leon McDonald at the time, and left with the feedback of, you've just got no empathy. And I was left so confused into what he was like meaning in terms of like, how's that affecting my rugby? And like, stewed on it for a while. Didn't even really know what the word meant, to be honest, at the time. And did some research, and what I got from it in the end was that I had no empathy for our forward pack. So I was a player who loved to play and play the space. Kicking wasn't a big part of my game. So go side to side to side. If we defended for a long period of play, I'd take a quick tap because I was fit and I still had heaps of energy. I saw them tired, but had no empathy for our forward pack and how much I was making them work. And like, we came last that year, and probably a lot of it was to do around my game management and how I had lack of empathy or for our forwards or how much I outworked them. So it was an interesting way about going about teaching me, but it was a cool one that once I worked out, I was like, oh, that is what he was talking about. Mm. Like,
yeah,
I was just so far off just playing my own individual game, but didn't really know anything else.
Understanding who you're with, eh, in any environment, you know, whether you're learning something or you're working, whatever it is, understanding who's supporting you towards that outcome and understanding what they need or what they don't need or what's putting them under more pressure.
Yeah.
The quick taps, it's, developing that is super important, whatever you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you see it with young game drivers at the moment around how much there is to learn around what you're working with. Game management is such an important part of the rugby game, but it's such a hard one to learn without going through it. It's such a hard one that I'm finding to coach quickly because you really need to experience it and feel it and learn from your mistakes and errors and what works and what doesn't.
Did you learn it in England? Did England, being in England, help with that? You know, just a completely different style? Because a lot of Kiwis look at English rugby and think, the way they do things is average, you know, and a lot of English look over here and think, well, the way they do things is average, and it's just the context or the experience that they're in.
Yeah.
Like, did that give you a broad understanding of?
I would have hoped I'd learnt it a little bit before that while at the Canes, but it definitely gave me a new insight into the way the game can be played. Like, I went in there with a mindset thinking, obviously coming off the back of a Hurricanes championship, sort of knew the right way to play rugby, and it was the way that we were playing at the time. And going over there was just, you know, frustrations to start with. Like, man, we just play with the ball zero. It's all about kick pressure, set piece, and but that's just the way they play. And there's the beauty of the game is that there's no right or wrong way to play the game. If you'll buy into your system or your approach, that you can be effective. And look at South Africa at the World Cup, compared to the French or the Japanese or whatever style of rugby that you play, there's more than one way to play it. And I learned that as especially good for my coaching around, as long as everyone's on that same page, then we can make our own style and choose that and use it like that.
You never think empathy is a skill that a rugby player is going to require. I've had zero professional rugby experience, but you never think, like, if you were to list, you know, the dozen skills that a rugby player would require, I wouldn't even have, you know, empathy on that list. Yeah. And did it change your behaviour? Do you think once you had that sort of
conversation? Once I sort of worked out what he was meaning and, how I could affect the rest of the team, it definitely did. And understanding what I can do to save other people's energy. Like, because I was naturally fit or worked hard on my fitness, I was never as tired as everyone else. So it took me a while to, I guess it was after that conversation, it's not just how I'm feeling right now, it's actually how's my whole team feeling? Like, I can't do this by myself. I need the whole team to have enough energy to execute the next play. So that was probably a big learning point for me, was around that. And it's not just about me here, it's about everyone.
Yeah, and that's a valuable skill for everything, right? Like, having empathy is something that'll do you well in any facet of life, sport or otherwise, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Family you talked life a little bit, as well. Oh, sorry.
No.
I was going to say, you talked a little bit about the Hurricanes before, and obviously you came into the Hurricanes at sort of quite an interesting time, that sort of 2013 sort of period. Mark Hammett was the coach. There were some big changes there, but ultimately led to, you know, a Super Rugby Championship in 2016. What was that period like for you? Going in, it's sort of like in the squad at 2012 to 4 years later, sort of lifting the cup.
Yeah, I was just so excited for an opportunity to play Super Rugby. I'd sort of been playing NPC for 4 years, just waiting for a crack at anywhere really. And I was a massive Hurricanes fan growing up. Had an obsession with Christian Cullen, and my love for the game really was around that. And then the opportunity to be in the environment. I remember first day getting picked up from the airport, straight into a beep test or yo-yo test, can't remember which one it was at the time, yo-yo it would have been, and just watching and running alongside some of my like childhood heroes like Conrad Smith and Matt Anono, Tim Bateman, all these guys, like just absolute honour to be in the room, and like so hard to, you know, stay cool about it all. Like you're just peeking around who you're actually training with and that you're actually in this environment that you always wanted to be in. And yeah, it's pretty cool.
Mm. And then to go through and not only be in the team, but then actually win, right?
Yeah, well, it was a slow progression again. Like it feels like my whole career was like first year was wider squad, just got a taste of the training. Second year, I probably had two or three games and both, I guess all my games, I feel like I didn't really nail my opportunity. Then the following year, there was an injury and I got an opportunity and then managed to play a bit better that year and continue to keep my starting spot. And then the year after that was the year we won it, where managed to have a starting spot the whole season and had so many gifted players competing for the same spot. So I never really thought my spot was going to be there for much longer. I always thought I was punching above my weight, and I guess that's where that self-awareness piece comes in. Like, I look back on that and whether that was right or not, that's essentially why I moved over to London Irish, because I thought I was maximising my potential at the time, starting in front of All Blacks and winning a Super Rugby title. Like, yeah, I never really thought I'd get there and to be there, and I thought I needed to make the most of it by essentially going overseas.
I think one thing you did, like I was obviously there for the first sort of 3 years of that, and one thing I think you did really was you almost became indispensable because of the things that you bring on the field, like communication and vision, all those things. You really lent into your strengths. But it was an interesting period, eh? Like there was a lot of sort of cultural shifts sort of going on at the time. Yeah. And I think about those earlier years, you know, it was the first year for like, you know, TJ and Julian and Bowden, like and a lot of those guys sort of came in at the same time. And so it was a real, like, you talk about 2016 being the end of that sort of rise. Yeah. There's like a maturity that went on through those sort of 4 years where all of a sudden really ready to perform, you know?
I think definitely. And I think you see it with a lot of teams. If you can keep the core group of guys together for a long period of time, then you're gonna be successful. And that's what I think they did really well during that period with a lot of those young guys you mentioned. And I remember, you know, that army camp we went on. You'll have some good stories about that.
Jesus.
But what was that, like a 24-hour day where we're just made to do incredibly tough things physically and then mentally and emotionally and give everyone feedback on what they are like as a person or a teammate, and some real honest conversations we had in that room. And I was grateful with some of the feedback I got, but some guys weren't, and it was incredibly tough. Like
that was still to this day for me probably one of the more challenging. You're broken. You've just gone through, you know, as Jimmy said, we turned up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, trained, and we didn't know what we were doing. And so we started training normally in the army. We were there. We started doing sort of more army-based training, and then that turned into like a whole night of stuff. Like we had to carry all this gear, and I think we sat, like it was almost like a little essay at like 4 in the morning on our game plan, and then we had to set our sleeping quarters up. We got to sleep at probably 8 in the morning or whatever it was, sleep for a couple of hours, and then went into sort of like feedback exercises. And you had to give like positive and negative feedback. You had to. And so we were in a group of sort of 15, and I'm like, I was receiving all this positive feedback, and I just broke down, eh? Like it was just like I was on the verge there personally with a few things going on at home with Laura and stuff, and just hearing all this positive feedback just literally broke me. It's still one of the more embarrassing sort of parts of my career, but it was a full on time, eh? It really was.
And I mean, you weren't the only one to break down. There was a lot of guys, some for the negative stuff, but yeah, when you just push that far mentally and physically and emotionally, like
it's so interesting that probably is the foundation for how you would build empathy if you were trying to build it in a team. Like guys understanding there's so many deeper layers to the human behind the guy that's showing up at training or the game. So it probably is like for, you know, where the Canes went to from there to winning a title, probably a lot of that foundational work would have played a big part on how tight they all got.
Yeah.
And then staying together, obviously, the other side of that, being there for.
And I guess they see who was willing to put in the work for each other and those things. Like, Some of the exercises were like, there's only one jerry can to carry, and it's like, who's going to lift it for the majority of that walk, or, you know, like who's going to take the more load than the others will. And you quickly see who's the guys who's just going to cruise out the back for a bit. And I guess the coaches are watching all that, but also the players around them. And then you get that feedback at the end and it hits you square in the eyes. And yeah, it's an interesting exercise.
It's that that combination of, like, as you've just talked about, Soph, like really understanding your teammates, like really understanding them. That provides a real sense of, you know, belonging in the group. And then combined with a huge amount of pressure, those two things together just create this where you become like quite a tight-knit unit, you know. And pressure can come in anything. It doesn't have to be through an army-style camp. But, you know, challenges is when, you know, an environment can either break or come together.
Yeah, and these are the other sort of the crossover skills we talk about all the time with rugby, I think, as you think about, you know, a work environment or your home environment with wife and kids, like the pressures are different, but those experiences and the skills you get from them are so transferable. I think it's like the same sort of thing, isn't it? Watching how you kind of both respond, or everyone responds to a stimulus, and then, you know, mentally noting it and then almost working to accommodate everyone's strengths and weaknesses is exactly what facilitates a good space, whether it's a family or a team or, you know, work environment.
You talked a bit about there about sort of feeling like I'm sort of reading between the lines, but you sort of felt like in that team you were almost out of place. You know, you sort of said, like, and amongst all these players, I sort of felt like I was waiting to be found out, sort of almost, you know, like that I thought I'd been punching outside my weight class, and that's sort of why you went overseas. But I think that's also maybe a strength. It's like with that mindset that, like, you know, I've got to earn this next week, this next day, this next session. It's like, I think that ties back to your work ethic. I think that you may have looked at that as a weakness, but I sort of see that as a strength, thinking like, you know, I've got to earn this next opportunity. And I think if more people thought like that about anything, it would be a different world.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at it. Like, I never took my position for granted because of that fact, really. Like, we had Julian Savier, Nehi Milner-Scudder, Corey Jane, Jason Woodward, and myself all fighting for the three spots, and three of them were All Blacks. One was a England international a few years later. So I knew that I was sort of punching above my weight, and I just knew that, I guess what you said, Timmy, was around the things that I added to the team. I had to make sure that were different to the others. And I guess the thing for me was around a lot of my strengths are really hard to be seen. Like, a lot of coaches or spectators definitely wouldn't see it. A lot of coaches wouldn't really either. So I guess I was grateful that the players who were in the leadership group or were close enough to the coach would often give that feedback to the coach that some of the things that I was adding to the team were really beneficial to everyone else. So while I was never a fan's favourite because of I wasn't a tackle breaker or, you know, I didn't have an amazing skill set, the things that I could add to the team, I know that my teammates really appreciated.
Like what?
Communication, decision-making, the mindset to always stay in the moment were probably the three things that I really felt like were my strengths. So the feedback that I could pass into the decision makers or Bodie at the time was often the guy. I felt like he really appreciated that information that I could feed into him, and it made him play the best rugby that he could play. Whereas when someone who was probably more physically capable, I think of Andre Taylor, who was one of the most gifted runners in Super Rugby at the time, probably didn't offer that same help to Bodie. And then it's sort of, I guess, a coach's decision. Do you want the best Bodie you can have in a average fullback, or do you want a average Bodie and a really good fullback? So I guess those were the decisions the coach had to make. But
and it's because it's a team game. Like, ultimately, rugby is about trying to move a ball over a line, you know, and then who's going to move that ball over the line the most.
Yeah.
And it requires 15 people operating at their best. And so if you've got players who can actually elevate everyone else around them, if that's an abnormal amount of difference that they can make to the other 14 people, that's exponentially better than an individual that can get 100% out of themselves.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I saw that. I mean, the other thing I'd add to you, because I, what you just said then, those three, your three sort of attributes that you brought, I could completely agree. There's one other, I think, that you've missed, which is just a real positive energy.
Mm.
And that there is, that's fostered in the group too, where you've got this real positive energy that people want to be around, people uplift, and you're sort of seeing the game through a real optimistic lens and, you know, but understanding the game at the same time. And that there's really contagious in a group as well.
Yeah. I always tried to be conscious of the energy and still am now as a coach around, man, it's so much more infectious when someone comes in and gives you energy than when someone comes in like looking flat. It's just like, it's contagious. So always really try and be conscious of the energy that I bring to the team. And I used to do the same on the field, try and just give as much energy. I felt like I had a lot to give, so I tried to give a lot of energy to the forwards, especially once I learned the empathy piece. And it's something that I've always tried to do, and can be challenging, especially when we're going through sort of runs like we are at the moment. And turn up, you're looking at pretty depressing footage of the week's game, and but still coming in with that same energy that this week's a new week, and try and let the team feel that.
Is it a natural trait of yours, energy? Because it's sort of like, I think energy is the lifeblood of everything. You know, it's like the more energy you have, the better parent you are. The more energy you are, the better you are at your role or position or your job. But it's a hard thing to capture and try and create.
It's definitely hard when you're not feeling it. Like, but I do feel like I do have naturally high energy. I'm not a coffee drinker. I have no caffeine or anything to sort of pump up my energy. It's just I've tried to live off natural energy. I pride myself on getting a good night's sleep when the kids are doing what they're told. And other than that, like, I feel like my energy is generally pretty high.
Yeah.
That's massive. I think that would be out of all the things we've spoken about. Obviously, I don't play rugby, so I don't know as much about that, but definitely with culture. There was that Gallup survey that was released last week, and the biggest takeaways were like any culture or any environment that's created, whether it's, you know, home environment or workplace, is overwhelmingly superseded by people's own microclimate. So exactly what you've just said.
Mm.
Like, you can have an incredible intention with the whole team culture, but if one person's bringing in this microclimate of storminess, sapping, whatever it is, that actually has far more impact on engagement and people's emotions than the entire group. Yeah. It like sort of spreads, like you just said, it's contagious.
Yeah.
And that's definitely something that I think for all the conversations I've ever had about you, Tim has always kind of described you as a person that just brings such a good energy. People really like you. And I think it's, you know, that's incredibly valuable, obviously, in teams that you've played with and now coach with. So, yeah, out of all of them, how good.
Oh,
yeah.
Appreciate it.
You've mentioned it a few times, but I do want to read out that Hurricanes backline, because it is crazy. You know, like when you think back now, you know, you sort of got TJ at 9, Bowden at 10, Julian Savera at 11, Martin Nono at 12, Conrad Smith at 13, Corey Jane on one wing, and then you know, fullback. Like, it's just like, it really is, like, when you talk about like even just like all back greats, like that's a
every single one of them is probably an All Black legend, except myself. I feel so out of place in that list of names. But
but I wonder how many of them are All Black legends because they've been in an environment that's had you. You're obviously paid to sleep like that, but I think that you can't underestimate that. Like, I think of conversations constantly with Tim or with Will or with anyone within spaces. Like, I think when you speak to players that have gone through a professional career, their insight into it is just completely different than spectators.
Yeah.
Just because they really do understand the foundational work and who it's laid by is massive. So. Mm. One of the biggest trade-offs of rugby is injuries. Mm. Will, as I feel like we ride this roller coaster, and I'm sure Brian is the same. But tell us a little bit about your journey with the injuries and how that all kind of played out.
Yeah, I never really had the soft tissues like Willie has. I was always really lucky around my soft tissue injuries. I had a dodgy hip from basically as early as I could remember in my rugby career, which used to cause a lot of tightness, but it wasn't until I got to sort of 24 where it was really starting to slow me down and a lot of pain, not so much in the game, but definitely post-training or warming up or anything like getting in the car, putting on my shoes, all those sort of things became real tough for me. So I had hip surgery on both my hips to hopefully get a few more years out of my career. And I remember the hip surgeon saying, you'll be lucky to play till 30. Like, so that was always sort of a goal for me. Whether he sort of manifested that age into my head and that was sort of the retirement for me. But yeah, that was probably the toughest challenge for me. I dislocated my shoulder coming back, which was probably my most painful injury. They couldn't put that back in, and that was just that was the worst. That was, it felt like everyone at the stadium had an attempt to try and put my shoulder back in until I got to the hospital and they put me to sleep, and then don't remember anything else. But yeah, they were probably the two main ones. I had hip surgery for the second time, which ended my career. And by that point, I was so over training and warming up for games or anything that I was happy to.
You knew it was time.
Yeah, I knew it was time. Like, I remember sitting in the Japan changing room before a game and trying to put on my sock, and I couldn't put my sock on. I had to get into this weirdest position, and everyone's like, look at me, like, what are you up to? And then I had to ask my coach to tie up my shoes, and I was like, this isn't a good look for a guy who's supposed to be a professional rugby player trying to get through this. And like, it was just, it was embarrassing, really. And in the warm up, the Japanese guys just always take the piss out of my matawaris, which was like a semi squat or like a half deep squat, but I just couldn't get any depth. So like, I knew that I was I was done. And yeah, when I had that second surgery, the rehab was 9 to 12 months, but in my head I knew this was a time for me to try and transition, because I didn't really want to get back to playing.
Yeah, and the transition, was it you went straight into sort of kind of a coaching role, was it right?
Yeah, well, just the way it worked with COVID and Carlos Spencer leaving the Hurricanes, Jason Holland just asked me if I would fill in that little gap for, we had about 6 games left. So it was a really quick transition of going from player into the coaching room and getting a feel for it. But I found it relatively easy at that time because I was doing so much of it anyway.
Yeah.
I felt like I was having a huge influence on the back line at that time. I wasn't playing a huge amount either because I was battling so much and form wasn't great. So, yeah, I didn't find that transition too hard, and I had the respect from the group already, so yeah, it wasn't too daunting.
That's smart from them, really, just to see that. And obviously one of your big traits being curiosity and just your natural ability to be able to read people in the game, this perfect, really, the transition into coaching. It seems like such a good fit for the person we're obviously finding out that you are.
And we sort of glossed over it a little bit before, but I mean, that you can't underestimate that. Like, you know, Jason Holland, it's an incredible coach, you know. He saw what you were doing on the field around bringing the best out of the players. We talked about some of the players before, and I can't emphasize that enough. Like, rugby is a team game, and so, you know, as individuals, we can help people around us. He saw that in you as a player.
Yeah,
so it's a really smart move, obviously, to move into that coaching space.
Yeah, interesting you see that. I was thinking about that before when you mentioned it around the team game point, because I remember the end of, I think it was 2019, when the Crusaders won the semi-final here with the hand of God moment with Sam Whitelock. And I was on the bench that week, and we'd had a few injuries, and I genuinely thought I was going to start, because I felt like I was, with my self-awareness, I felt like I was genuinely our best option to start at fullback. But they didn't go that way, and they put Jonah Lowe there, who was a quality player and is a quality player. But I remember talking to Jason Holland after that game, or in our end of season review, and I sort of said, like, asked a question around the selection of the semi, because I was pretty gutted about it. He's like, oh, I never knew you were gutted. Like, you handled that well. But what was your thought process? And he just said, I thought Jonah was a better player. And I said, I agree. I think Jonah's a better player, but I think the team would have been better if I was in there. And he's like, shit, that's a really interesting way to look at it. And you're probably right. Like, I came on at halftime because another injury. So he said when you came on, the team was definitely going better than when you weren't on. So it was just an interesting way to look at it. And
yeah, like individuals make the team better, obviously, by the way that they can support or pull away from, but also, as you touched on before, Soph, like individuals get better because of other individuals around them. Anyone that gets to the top of anything and thinks that they're the only reason that they're there, they're kidding themselves. They're there because of a whole heap of things that have gone on their whole career, well, their whole lives, obviously, too. And so, like, people like yourself are people that bring the best out of people.
Yeah.
You know, and that's massive skill set.
It's something for people to be aware of when they're bagging the All Black team or any team that they think should be selected with just the best players, just to be aware of that the guy you might not think is the best player will be adding something that the guy who is breaking more tackles or is harder to tackle is offering. So, because everyone, you look at the All Black team when it's selected, everyone wants the game breakers in there. Like, this team should be so much better with him. And rightly so, they're probably all better players, but and individually, but some of those guys who are still there, who get bagged, offering a lot in terms of what they add to the game with game management, communicate, all those things you don't see as a fan.
It's interesting, you know, from someone without any exposure to professional sport, but a huge fan, you know, all these things you guys are talking about are not things that I would put on that list of, you know, like you're talking about energy, you know, communication, empathy, like all crazy things that sort of are, you know, ultimately helping a team perform or not, but, you know, and not something from a fan's point of view that you generally see as a desirable trait for someone to fulfill that position.
Yeah, I don't think you'd go to any school and say, who's your favourite player? It's the guy who's got the best communication and empathy.
Yeah, indeed. And then obviously, you know, now you're with the Crusaders as well, and that's sort of a bit of a full circle moment, I guess, for you, because, you know, you talked about Andrew Goodman before being a sort of a mentor in training you, and then all of a sudden you sort of become his peer along with the likes of, you know, Scott Robinson and Scotty Hansen as well. What was that like?
I think the thing for me was around the coaching. I never I thought I'd be a coach as a player, but then I got to the point where I was not that keen to be a coach due to the amount of moving we had to do as a family. And I know my wife, Bryony, was pretty strong around that we, once we settled or finished rugby, that we could settle in one place. So once we left Wellington, we settled in Mapua and Nelson. So the coaching dream was essentially not something that I was looking to chase at all. A job came up and an opportunity came up in Tasman to sort of do it while we were living in Nelson, but that was sort of as far as I was thinking it was going to go, until the call from Razor. And then people say it was a no-brainer. It must have been a no-brainer getting a call, but it was genuinely a really tough decision for us as a family because we were so settled. We'd been in Mapua for 2 years. I'd sort of promised I wouldn't move the family around for chase another dream of mine. Had to get that real buy-in from my wife at the time. We're still together, still happily married, and make sure that it was the right decision for us as a family. So we had to, we'd do the big move, we'd commit to the move down to Christchurch, and the deal was that then now Christchurch would be our home. So hoping that we don't have to move anytime soon, and it looks like Christchurch is going to be our home. And even if I do get sacked from the Crusaders for a poor run of games, that I've set ourselves up enough that I could jump into something else if that was, and I wasn't held ransom to having to move to another country for another coaching job. Like, if another coaching job came up and I was sacked, we would be in the position to make a decision on what's best for the family, not, guys, we all have to move here because this is the only source of income we have, hence the podcast and hence trying to keep that going in the background.
Yeah. It's something you don't think about, I think, from the outside, is that, you know, for a player or a coach, you know, it's that, you know, you do have to balance your aspirations and dreams with that of your families, and they might not always align.
Yeah. And you see it, I think that's a huge struggle for, especially a lot of young guys in early relationships. Like, someone in the relationship is going to have to make a sacrifice for someone else's dream. And if you're a rugby player, you're hoping that your partner is going to make that sacrifice for you. And I'm so grateful that my wife has made many, many sacrifices. We've moved over 20 times. We've had that many new houses or shifts. We used to have to go from Taranaki to Wellington. We did that 4 times. We moved to England. We moved to Japan, Japan, Wellington, Japan, Wellington. So we've moved so many times. So I know why she wanted to just settle, and especially with kids, the moves were getting harder. And that's why that decision was a lot harder than probably looks on paper around opportunity to coach with some of the best coaches in the world and get your foot in the door in the coaching world. And I guess the question from Bryony was, well, what's next? Like, you get your foot in the door with the Crusaders, and then someone else is going to come calling, Leinster will come calling, or something like that. And then what? Like, where does it stop?
Yeah.
Is the question from her, which was a fair question. And that's why I've been conscious around what that exit plan looks like.
Yeah, I guess it's just different stages of family life as well, right?
Yeah.
How old are your kids now?
My kids are 8, 5, or 6 next week, and 3, 1 on the way. So soon to be 4 boys in a very busy household. And
lucky you've got lots of energy, eh?
Lots of energy to give to lots of kids.
Yeah.
And one thing I'm always so in awe of, you and Bryony are both just so chill. Like, you're always the same, and I know Finn's babysat your boys, and she said the boys are the same. You're all just like such a lovely, just calm, fun people.
I wish the kids were like that all the time. They're definitely not chill, but they are. They do have a chilled side, which we hear from people when they look after them. But they're definitely not chill at home for us. And I know Brian. Oh, I've just been away for the last 10 days. She would definitely say they're not chilled kids, but
especially when she's close to having them before. But that's cool.
And
Bryony, I think that's a massive time for a shout out. Obviously, that's something I'm so passionate about. Is behind every rugby player that's doing that, if there is that support network, whether it's a partner, a wife, whatever it is, it takes a certain type of personality. And it really is, like, lots of people I speak to, players in particular, refer to that as their armor. The ability to go out and do what you do is because of being provided that by your support network.
100%, yourself included.
Well, it's a big role. And Bryony's a legend, but
At the moment, I want to talk about a little bit with the Crusaders at the moment, because it's a tough time. It's sort of 1 from 8 in the season. And how, as a coach, as a leader, do you sort of maintain optimism and sort of a forward focus? And I don't ask through a rugby lens, like, we're not interested in that. I'm asking because people will listen to this podcast and someone will be 1 from 8 in their job this year. Someone will be 1 from 8 in their relationship or in their ability to and it just, like, keep getting a smack in the head every time they try and do something, and they'll feel that they don't they're not doing what they could be, and you're in that position, maybe sort of in a position like that, at least from externally, it appears like that. How, you're a leader, you're a coach, like, what's your attitude going in to help, turn things around and stay positive and optimistic?
Yeah, it's definitely a good question, and we're definitely in that at the moment. But I think it's just about looking at the next job. The sooner you flush the previous moment, obviously you take the lessons from the game or whatever, and you do your review properly. But as soon as you can start looking forward and getting excited to the next game, the more benefit it's going to be. And I guess it'd be the same in any workforce. And when you sort of look at the whole picture, well, yes, we're 1 from 8. But the reality is we can still win the competition. And that's something that I've always felt really strongly about. And I still do. And a lot of people would look at that and say, geez, you're delusional or something like that. But the reality is, if we go on a run over the next few games, we're getting some pretty important personnel back through that period of time. When we get to playoffs, we're going to be an extremely hard team to beat, and I genuinely think we can still win this competition. So that genuine belief is still there, and we could lose the next 2 games and that genuine belief will be gone because it won't be possible. But then you're just really just looking at next job. How can we be better next week? And But yeah, at the moment, there's still that carrot at the end of the tunnel. And I guess I do really believe, I don't know when this is going to be released. So it might be different once it is, but I still really believe that this team can win the competition.
Yeah. It's funny, like you talked about one of your strengths earlier on being, you know, you're really present and on the field, you know, you can be in the game.
Yeah.
Like you've obviously overlaid that into now. Like you seem to be, like we're going to talk a little bit later on around just balance and how you balance everything that you've got going on in your life. And one thing that keeps on popping up is that you're just able to be really present, you know, like you're not, don't get flustered about what's just gone on. You don't get too flustered about what's coming. It's just like, actually, what can I do now? And like even your answer to this question was the same thing. You're like, well, I can't change any of that. There's no point me even wasting energy. It's like, I think we can do really well. These are the things that I can focus on to get us there. And you're just in that, you know, which is, I think, that's, once again, I think it's a great trait to have.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that until talking with Bryony around like my work-life balance, like after you mentioned it. And she said she thinks that's probably a reason why I can juggle so much or have so much on my plate is because I don't spend a huge amount of time worrying about what's about to happen, and I don't spend much time worrying about what's happened. So I hadn't ever really thought about that myself, but once you mentioned it, it sort of made sense. And again, I don't know how I can do that or not, or where it's come from, but I just think that there is no real point in wasting so much energy if you can avoid it. And ways to do that, I feel like often just trying to zoom out of things and look at the bigger picture. I guess the weekend was one good example. We lost to the Force in a game we should never be losing, really, over there. It was such a hard one for me sitting on the sideline, like, Jesus, watching that last sort of 10 minutes thinking, man, where are we actually at here? Like, what am I doing? Like, what can I be doing better? All those sort of thoughts go through your head, and then how do you get away from that? And often I just zoom out and look at how small I am in this whole world, and how rugby's really important. I want the Crusaders to win, but when you really look at the big picture, it's not the end of the world, these losses. And time is the other thing. Like, fast forward and look at it. I like to try and think of what I'd look back at it in sort of 5 years, and it's just another story to tell around the tough times we had. And I think that's another often one that can put a bit of reality into your situation. And those two things sort of help me move on a lot quicker than some people. I know some people will hold on to a loss for a very long time and let it sit with them.
Well, it allows you to move on quicker, but it also allows you to have more going on in your life too, because you're not so stuck to something that's going on. And obviously one of those other big things that's going on for you at the moment is, you know, you've got your podcast, you know, like, and so you've touched on how it's something that you've, you know, been working on for a long time, and it provides you a little bit of flexibility to make decisions that you want to make around coaching as well, just having that there. Like how did that come about? And are you enjoying it? Are you enjoying the?
Yeah, I definitely enjoy it. It came about once I had my hip surgery. I was sort of thinking of potential career options. Coaching was one of them. But again, like I said, didn't want to have to go down that chase the coaching dream path. The other one was sort of working with like an academy or young kids who wanted to pursue the career. So started the podcast, started coaching with Tasman, and got a job at Nelson College with the rugby class there. So sort of did the three things that I wanted to do and just sort of saw which one took off the most. And I was enjoying all three of them, to be fair. And the coaching got a bit busier, and then the podcasting I wanted to grow. So then the first one gone was the Nelson College role. And then the Crusaders opportunity came, but I didn't want to drop the podcast, although wasn't sure if it was going to be possible to be able to do both. And it's been a real balance, especially in season, but thankfully off season there's real opportunity for me to really double down on my podcasting. And in season's a little bit of just a survival mode, like try and bank as many before the season and schedule the episodes throughout the year, and bye week was another one for me to rebank and a few more episodes. But I definitely can't put as much time into it as I'd like to at the moment. But post Super Rugby season, I'll look to double down a little bit more.
You've interviewed so many greats. I feel like it's probably one of the only podcasts that if we're all in the car, we're all happy to listen to it. You've got a great voice and a great temperament. But what are some things about the interviews or the kind of common themes that have surprised you? Like, has there been like a common thread of thinking among those kind of elite success stories?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I guess the main challenges that everyone's faced is selection, injuries. Everyone's had those setbacks, and it's how they've handled those throughout their career. Like, the ones who have really kicked on have handled those moments really well, and they've used them as opportunities to come back better and stronger. And the ones who haven't often have really struggled and I guess felt sorry for themselves a little bit during that time. But then often what you guys have already spoken around, work ethic, all the greats have work ethic, and then on top of that, different approaches to the game, or I guess it's the sort of mindset that they have going into the game is the ones that separates the goods from the greats, is work ethic and mindset. If I had to put it into two, would be those two.
It's massive. And I think that's the thing, you provide such an understanding of the things I'm talking about. I imagine that's why guys feel so comfortable sharing on the podcast, because it is, I think, like Maddie's just said, it's hard not being an insider to understand all of those things that people don't see.
Yeah.
And it is, it's an awesome platform, I think, for guys to share that kind of human side of themselves.
Yeah, I'm just trying to give a real trusting method where they can come on and share what they feel, and if they feel that changes or they feel like they didn't portray it the way they would have liked to, then there's an opportunity for me to take that out, or we could re-record. It's never about clickbait for me, and yeah. I've said it before that I would rather 100 really loyal followers who just love it so much and get so much out of it than a million who it's all about clickbait, and I've made stories out of nothing and really controversial and put the guys who've come on into a bad position. So that's what it's always been about for me, and I guess the guys sort of feel that and then are willing to share a little bit more than they usually would to most media outlets.
So good.
Yeah, it's a long-term thing. I mean, if you zoom out, like that, the long-term, that is how you do get to those, you know, is by having that genuine connection on the way through. But I want to talk about just the balancing thing a little bit more, because, like, I don't know how you do it. Like, I know what goes into running a podcast. I've got no idea what goes into coaching a Super Rugby team, but I can only imagine. And then, you know, you've got three kids, you know, a wife who's pregnant, you've got another one coming, three boys. Obviously, you've got a lot of energy, but we actually reached out to Bryony and asked, you know, like, how you do it, you know, because it is from the outside looking in, it does seem like a challenge. And she, again, sort of what we've already been talking about, she said that, that it's your best strength is that you're never a stressor, that you're always calm and always present, which, like, I wish my wife would say those things about me, but I always assure you she wouldn't. Like, you know, it's quite a sort of a you've talked quite stoically about the things before. Like, it's, you know, particularly when you're throwing family, because kids are humbling, you know, and kids don't care that you've got work on or you've got something on this afternoon that you need. You know, podcast is not something you can show up to, I assume, nor there's a Super Rugby game, unprepared.
Yeah.
You know, like, you've got to have done work beforehand. And, like, is it, like, are you doing late hours? Is it late nights, early mornings? Like, how are you able to fit all this in around but still have a wife that says you're really present, really calm, and you're never a stress?
Yeah, geez, that's nice words. Thanks for that, Bryony. I feel like I'm just, probably because I love it, it doesn't feel as hard as it probably should. Like, I am probably literally working from as soon as I wake up to as soon as I go to sleep, but that work is stuff that I love, and thing I've tried to do with my coaching is I've always tried to be back by five, And I'll try and not do any work till the kids are asleep, which used to be 7 and is now getting later and later. But between that, I've tried to make that my family time. Days off, I'm trying not to go into work. So that's another day where I'm much more efficient when I'm working by myself. And if I go into the base, then I'm caught in so many different conversations, which I don't really need to be having. So I'm just trying to be really efficient with the work that I'm doing. And then the podcasting is, I'm just trying to make the most of opportunities when I can. So the flight to Perth, I've done all my rugby stuff. I've got a 5-hour window. I'm editing podcasts or doing clips or just trying to get on top of that stuff. Way trips in my hotel. Once I've done my coaching work, I'll have opportunities to really nail it and get ahead of the game for the rest of the season, because I know those opportunities when I'm at home don't become available. So I guess the hardest thing for me is balancing my fitness, that sort of thing, like being able to prioritize myself is probably the thing that I still struggle with. Find myself in good routines at times. Like I was waking up early, going to the gym before I'd start my looking at the computer at work. But when you start getting travel and you come back with a bit of jet lag, those mornings get a bit harder. I did manage to get up and go for my first run in about 3 years this morning before a podcast, and then this podcast, and then I'll go catch up with some players now after this. So I think it's just about being really efficient with my time and not wasting too much time. Like what Bryony said, stressing around what's going to come. Like, no offense, but I've spent no time planning for this or stressing about this. I've just come and shared what has come to mind as you guys have spoken. So I guess some people would come onto a podcast and mentally prepare or potentially spend a couple of hours taking notes or writing down ideas that might come to mind. But for me, I can't afford to do that at the moment. Like, it's just not valuable for my time efficiency. So trying to be as efficient as possible is a long way.
Like the interesting thing around balance for me is like, because you obviously want to be high performing.
Yeah.
You want to be high performing in everything. You want to be a great coach. You want to be a good dad. You want to be a good husband. You're talking about, you know, you want your health and fitness to be better because you're wanting what's best for yourself. You're wanting to have an awesome podcast. And so if you're trying to be really fantastic at a lot of different things, you know, and you're working on balance, how can you balance those? My question in a long-winded way, I guess, is like, do you think having balance makes you better at each individual thing, or do you think it chips away at it? Because I think about, as a professional rugby player, you know, we're told, you know, some people it's like, you know, good men make good rugby players, or good women make good rugby players because they've got other stuff going on. For other people that we've seen along the way too, they're just so single-minded in their approach. There's no balance. You know, like some people I know that wouldn't spend time with their family, you know, because they're trying to get every single minute out of their recovery and their preparation and stuff as well. So like, be high performing in your area that you want to be high performing in, but then trying to get balance. How does that fit? You know, where does that fit for you?
It's a good question. And I once had a guy on my podcast who sort of broke that down. His name was Tim Bateman. And just the way that I learned so much from that episode with you, actually, around the balance and the different pillars of life, really, and how they can all inspire or like help each other, I guess. And I think if you spend too much time on one thing, it becomes a real drain. So I love being able to jump from a coach to a quick hit of podcasting work and then go spend that time with my family, and it just sort of re-energizes and keeps everything quite fresh. And I think I was lucky to learn from, I guess, Scott Robinson, where I got to see that in the flesh the first year down here, where he would prioritize his mornings to himself by going for a surf. He'd come in really fresh with good energy. And you see that as someone who often you feel guilty for doing something like that, not coming straight in and going on your computer. But seeing that made me realize that if I prioritize other things, I'm going to be better, more efficient when I do my work, and going to have better energy about me. So, I think you nailed it in the question around, definitely helps having different things going on, and they do feed off each other, I believe.
Especially when you're passionate about all of them. I think. It's like the, for me, it's almost observing or listening to you. It's, you're showing up as the same person in each sort of entity. It's not like you're having to like pretend that you care about it or pretend that you enjoy it.
Yeah.
You can just be James. That's why, because I'd be the same. I find it really hard preparing or having to feel like I need to prepare for things because you're not having to just show up as yourself.
Yeah.
But, you know, the podcast, the coaching, anything else you're doing, home life, you're the same throughout.
Yeah.
I think that's a self-awareness thing. It probably mitigates a bit of your stress. Well, not that you have much, obviously, but you have lots of stress, but you don't see them as a stress. You see them as a joy, almost, which is awesome. Yeah.
And it's, I think I'm just thinking about like Bryony, who's at home, who has to look after kids for a lot longer periods. And I come home for a short hit, 3 hours, where I can be really a fun dad and give a lot of energy, where I know how much she craves a break sometimes. And it's just because even if you love doing one thing, if you do it forever,
so
you're going to get sick of it. So no matter how much you love something, still try and find other ways to give that thing you love more energy by doing other things or spending time on yourself or family or whatever that might be, hobbies. So then when you do go back to it, still got that real love for it and passion for it.
So good. I know you guys use OStudio a little bit. What are the kind of key services that you're into there?
Well, the float's the big one for me. Like, I crave a float after I often travel. If I come back from travel, if I just feel really worn down or feel like some of the work has just been like, I'm overloaded right now. I've just been going too flat. I haven't had a break. My sleep's been average. I crave a float. Mm. I know Bryony loves a yoga. She comes in whenever she can. I was in a really good yoga routine, but have struggled to prioritize myself there at the moment, but I do love that. Sauna, I love it all. Sauna, ice bath, I really love that for my mindset, like mentally. Lucky enough to have one at Cold Bath at the rugby base at the moment. So I managed to, when I'm in a good routine, get in that after a quick workout in the morning. And just, I think ice therapy is such a cool way to start a day. It gives you such a good hit of energy and you feel so good after it. But I guess the big one for me at OStudio has been my floating. Just such a good way to get away and let your thoughts go and come away feeling really fresh and rejuvenated.
Which when you're balancing as many things as you are, it's just as important, right? Looking after yourself.
Yeah, well, that was a hard thing at the start for me. I often found like, how am I going to find an hour to give myself to float in my busy schedule? And that was it. It's around just prioritizing it, knowing that once you do that, you'll be more effective in the rest of the day and in your work. So sometimes it's a hard way to look at it because you think, shit, or you're in there just thinking about all the things that you should be doing right now, but knowing that that is going to benefit you for the rest of the day, once you can realize that, then you can relax and you can wake up when the beautiful music starts and you just know that you've had such a peaceful 45 minutes in the room.
Yeah.
One, just to change tack slightly, because I think it's coming up a lot from what I'm sort of hearing and seeing as well. But like, you get a lot of opportunities put in front of you, like, and you've created, you know, success in a lot of different areas. You know, like, you talk about, you know, being selected in a team that you potentially felt like there might have been other players. Mm. You know, creating a really successful podcast. You've done well in a lot of different areas, and I think, like, one skill set I think you have that's, once again, I think underestimated when people are looking at performance, is you're just the person that people want to be around. You're a good person and at its core, you know what I mean? And so, like, the reason why players come more than happy to come into your podcast is just what you talked about before. Like, they know that you've got their back, that they can trust you 100%. So it makes for a better interview because they can just sort of relax and, you know, and settle in. You know, it's the same with, you know, they in a rugby environment or in a coaching environment, you'll get opportunities because you're a good person. Like, is that something that you you try to be? You try to be a good person, or, you know, or is it just something that's natural?
Jeez, I'm feeling so good about myself after this podcast. You guys,
that's funny because it's even mimicked by our staff here. Like, even I said, we had you on today, and the rest of the team will be like, oh, him and Brian are both so nice. Like, you're just really nice, good people, which seems like it shouldn't be shocking, but, you know, just the interaction with anybody at any level, you're obviously just a great person.
Oh, it's very humbling to hear. And I feel like everyone should be trying to be a good person. Like, I guess the big thing that I've always tried to live by is treat people how you'd like to be treated. I guess that's something that's lived with me for a long time. It's a very old, probably a very old saying, but it's so true. Like, there's no reason for you to not do that, and I don't understand why people wouldn't. Like, there's no need to be rude to someone for stuffing up an order or all these little things in life that people can get so wound up about. There's no reason to beep the horn because someone's trying to merge in because he's gone the wrong lane or something. Like, some people get wound up about things for no reason, and like, yeah, I don't know why or how, but I just try and be a good person, try and treat people how I'd like people to treat me. And
yeah, and you're right, because the one way to look at it is because there's no reason to. You should just be a good person. The flip of it is opportunities come off the back of that. Just by, I've heard you say it previously, actually, you never know who's watching, who's listening, where a conversation is going to lead. And so if you're just consistently a good person, really present and trying to be helpful and kind, and that what happens off the back of that over time is that more opportunities come, is that you get potentially put ahead of somewhere else. And so you don't do it for that reason, obviously, but just the follow on from just being like that regularly, consistently for a long period of time, is that more opportunities come.
Yeah. It's interesting. Someone said, I don't know who it was, said to me, but you know, when you've got all those sponsors events and sometimes they can be quite painful and always feel a bit uncomfortable going to introduce yourself and do all that sort of stuff. But someone said to me around, if you treat everyone like they're really famous, like, would it change your perception? Like, if you look at famous people, or if someone really famous cut you off in the line, or if Lionel Messi came and gave you the wrong drink, would you still be such a dick to him, or would you actually, would you still go get a photo with him and say you're a legend? Or why not treat people like they're all famous? And it's an interesting way to think about it. I know you can't do it realistically with everything, but just a mindset switch sometimes around, why am I actually being rude to this guy? Like, is it because he's perceived lower than me? Is it because he's homeless? That
I love that.
There's that clip of Ronaldo doing tricks as a homeless man on YouTube, and like, everyone, no one gives, and then he takes his stuff off and crowds of hunt, and it's just such a, shows you that society, though, isn't it? Like, no one cares about people who are struggling, even if it's the same person. Like, it's such a fascinating world. People's, I guess, perception of fame and how different they treat famous people compared to a normal person. Mm. And I was never famous as a rugby player, but often if someone found out, or if I was wearing my, like, the difference I'd be treated is if I was wearing my Hurricanes top, not that I was wearing it out of the team, but
yes, you were.
When I was traveling with the team, I was treated a lot differently to when I wasn't, or if like someone found out that I was a professional rugby player, then I remember an air host coming down and giving me extra stuff and said, I heard that you're with the Hurricanes. I was like, why are you just treating me like this compared to someone else? Like, before that, you knew that I was a professional rugby player. I just find it really weird that people change the way they treat people because of status, their title or status. So just try and treat everyone like they've got status, and might change the way you live your life.
It's a great way to look at it. Mm. We want to sort of finish off in a little bit of sort of, like, you know, the same way that you've finished off at Waterland. So we've actually reached out to our networks and asked for a couple of questions.
Okay.
A couple of stories have come back, and so I hope you won't mind sharing. One of them is the pre-season Ocean to Peak race in the Hurricanes is quite popular, and there was a story around when you tried to become a bookie for that event.
Yes.
Does that ring any bells?
It does. So the Surf to Peak was the annual event And oh, I always loved my punting or gambling, and I was right into it in that stage. So I wasn't in that year. Probably, I think I just had hip surgery. So I thought a good way to make it quite interesting was to do up some odds. And I know a lot of guys on the team love to punt. So basically made a book for everyone in the team. I think Cullen Gibbons, who had won it the previous year, was $1.50 favourite. And I remember Mark Stafford, actually, he came in that week and saw my odds up on the board, and he said I'd cook the book a little bit, like my percentage wasn't quite right. But ever since that, he knew that I had this fascination with being a bookmaker and loving doing odds. So always kept in close contact with him, and that was sort of a job that I thought I might go down. Oh, was, yeah. But then he obviously, during COVID, that all sort of went under, and that job was no longer there. So, but it's fascinating. That's another example of you never know who's watching going to come in. Like, here's me just doing this for a little bit of fun. And
well, he sent that opportunity. You cooked the books.
I definitely cooked the books. And I did it through, we had Supercoach a couple of years later, where we'd have a Supercoach group, and everyone who was playing head to head, I'd do head to head odds. And each week, guys would put punts on. So I was the bookmaker there, made sure those odds weren't cooked. And I remember Chris Eaves actually won a multi off me, which was over $1,000, which was really, luckily, I'd already banked up enough money that it didn't come out of my own pocket. But I remember at the time being heavily involved in that.
Funny. One more story we have here is you obviously play the game odds, or we call it chances.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently there's a good story from the Guinness factory in Dublin.
This must have been Bryony, was it? Because she's the only one there. But, yeah, we went to the Guinness factory in Ireland, and she's the most uncomfortable person at doing things in public ever. So I said, what would the odds be for you to dance in front of, like, someone had just started playing the piano on the in front of quite a big crowd who are about to do a tour. I just thought it would have been so good if I could get her up there. And one, she said, oh, no chance, like 150. And I was like, okay, we both had a go, I was way off. And then she said, okay, right to reply. And then we both said the same answer. So I had to go up and dance in front of, must have been like 50 people. Well, I hate dancing in public. Wedding dance was something that still gives me the shivers. I hate dancing, and I had to go up there and just dance for a good couple minutes while everyone clapped me on. And it was just, thank God there's no footage of it, because it would have been so embarrassing. But it's such a good game, that odds.
Isn't it? Yeah, yeah. I've seen some crackers as well. How about, you never know who's watching. There might have been a career opportunity as well.
Well, no dancing opportunities have come from it. So.
Not yet. Fingers crossed.
Not yet, yeah.
Hey, look, we just want to say a huge thank you. You know, like you talked, for me, this has been really eye-opening. Again, I've said it a number of times, but those traits you've talked about are never something I'd associate with a rugby player. And, you know, you sort of, your humility is really interesting, because you keep talking about how you felt out of place in those teams, and even sort of maybe, you know, you're sort of punching above your weight class. But at the same time, I think that all those environments are high-performing environments, and high-performing environments, I don't care about your feelings. You know, you're there because of what you bring. And so as much as you can feel that, I think you've obviously added something to those teams and those clubs and the groups and your family that that is really worthy of your being there. So just as much as they're grateful for your time, we're grateful for your time. We appreciate it. We wish you all the best with the rest of the season, with whatever's next, and of course, with Waddle Ad as well. Jimmy Marshall, thank
Mate,
you.
Mate, appreciate it. It's such an awesome podcast, the three of you working together like this, and big listener, and love your work. So an absolute honour to be on.
Good man. Cheers, Jimmy.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of the O Studio podcast. If you like this podcast, there are two things you can do to help us out. The first is to click on the follow button wherever you are listening, and the second is to jump on social media and follow us at O Studio Global. We've just launched new pages there, so we've got some growing to do. If you could do that for us, that would mean so much. Our purpose at O Studio is to make holistic wellness as accepted, as understood, and as practiced as physical fitness. To achieve this, we're building premium wellness hubs around New Zealand where communities come together to do things like sauna, ice bath, yoga, Pilates, meditation, flotation therapy, massage, recovery, and so much more in beautiful and normal environments with everyday people. If you want to join us on this journey, come and visit us at a location near you. Visit ostudio.co.nz for all the details. Own the moment.